introverted noise.
Hurry up, Daddy.
Let's do it.
5 seconds to go in the first half. Dante fires deep to the left. Moss caught it at the 11, but now he pitches it.
Look at this!
Jamal Williams! Touchdown!
You gotta be kidding me!
All right, and welcome back to another episode of the Climbing the Pocket podcast. I am your host, Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. And we're rolling with a bit of a short crew here, which is, I guess, probably a little unacceptable. We missed a week. We're coming back. It's supposed to be all of us. It's not all of us. Folks got good reasons for not being here, but we're still going to bring it. We're still going to bring a good show for you here because, you know, I'm here. But the name that you all care about, the man you really all came to hear, QB1, JR, my man, how's it going? How you been?
I'm good, man. Feels like it's been forever since we recorded, but I'm excited to be here and, you know, happy to be back home.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, let's get right to it here because, you know, it's been a little while. And I mean, I know you got to be a little disappointed since the last time we talked. I mean, you know, there were some playoffs happening the last time we were on, and just like that, they were gone. You know, I guess, you know, before we really get into all of this, I guess, what are your thoughts on kind of how things went? Because even in the group chat, the group message, you were a little bit more quiet than usual. We'll chalk it up to you being busy with work or something. But, you know, I feel like you just didn't want to hear Miles going off and talking about Steph Curry and all of those light skin things. So I guess what are your thoughts on the final series, how it all went down? And then we can jump into the show and the questions that we had written down.
Yeah, I needed some time to lick my wounds, man. Everybody knows I'm a LeBron stan. I'm a huge LeBron fan, and it was just rough watching the finals and see how it went down, especially after game one. I knew it was probably over after the game one situation and what happened with J.R. Smith there at the end of the game, not knowing the situation. But it was tough seeing them get swept, but we all knew that they didn't really have a chance at winning that series as such. An inferior opponent like Golden State, they would be lucky to win two games. I thought it was going to end in six games, but didn't surprise me at all that it ended up in a sweep. And that game four was just terrible. It was a blowout waiting to happen, and I seen it coming at the beginning of the game.
Man, and one thing that I've noticed here, because, I mean, JR is funny to not you, JR, but JR Smith, JR, is fun to clown on because he's JR Smith, and he does, you know, he does funny things on a pretty regular basis. He forgets he's in games and things like that. So it's real easy to clown on JR. But, like, George Hill has managed to skate 100% on this whole thing here. Like, everyone forgot that George Hill is even the one who missed the free throw because J.R. Smith forgot to call timeout. And Tyronn Lue also seems to have skated on that one because he also could have called timeout from the bench. I mean, LeBron could have called timeout, too. I mean, like, anybody could have called timeout when he got that rebound. So it's funny that, like, the whole weight of all that game one loss went 100% on J.R. when, I mean, there were a couple of people who could have done something to maybe have it go a different way there. So, yeah, I mean, pretty much you could tell, like, the look on LeBron's face after that game went to overtime even. I mean, I feel like he knew at that point that was their one chance to steal a game and maybe try to make it a series, maybe get a mental edge over the Warriors, maybe put some doubt in Steph and those guys' mind that, you know, they're able to do that or that he might be able to come in and shock the world again. And pretty much once that opportunity went away, it seemed to just go completely the other way where, like, LeBron was getting his numbers and he was doing his thing, but it just never really felt like he was the dominant force that he was in game one. Or maybe he just wasn't able to. Maybe he was too tired, but it seemed like at that point, like you said, even in that game, everything changed. And then, you know, after the fact, after the sweep, and I definitely, as a LeBron fan, I need to get your opinion on this piece here, is that you know, immediately following the sweep, basically like the clock hits zeros and we immediately hear from, I guess, LeBron's guy, Brian Windhorst, that LeBron had broken his hand in a self-inflicted fit of rage after game one, which is 100% understandable based on what he did in that game. And for them to lose, him losing his cool, I get it. I understand it. He's a human being. So I'm not going to come down too hard on him for that. We all do stupid things from time to time. But what are your thoughts on just the way that was all handled, A, in the media, and then LeBron immediately coming out after the game with the soft cast on and, and all of that. I mean, he is prone to some dramatics here and there, I guess. What were your thoughts as you were watching all of that unfold in terms of how he handled that and the injury and all those things in the wake of his team getting swept?
Yeah, I didn't really have a problem with him wearing a soft cast. I know that people were probably seeing it as an excuse or something like that, but just taking my total bias out of it, I didn't have a problem with it, because if he did wear the cast after the injury happened, he probably would be sending a signal off to the Warriors that he has a weakness, and that they probably would have came after his hand, seeing that it had a soft cast on it or whatever that he was wearing on it. So I thought I was fine with him wearing it after game four, after they did get swept, as opposed to wearing it after whenever it happened in between those four games. And I didn't really see it as an excuse or anything like that, like some were trying to make it out to be. And that's just my total unbiased opinion. So I didn't really have any problems with it, because he didn't use it as an excuse either. He didn't come out and say, oh man, I've had a broken hand since such and such, such and such, just going on and on about it. He addressed it and he just moved on from it. And he admitted the Cavs' flaws throughout the entire series and moved on from it.
All right. All right. All right. Well, I mean, enough of that. I mean, the series pretty much went how we thought it was going to go. So what's the next thing here? Because I feel like we've been away for a little while and, you know, we're going to hop right back in with an episode that is, it's going to make David upset with how we're starting off here, because we're going to talk about some basketball before we hop into the football talk here. So, I mean, it's going to be the topic of the summer. Where's LeBron going to end up? And why do you think he's going to go there? Is the next move going to be a purely basketball move? Is he going to try to find the best situation for himself? Or are off the court things like potential, you know, business opportunities after the court, or, you know, maybe being in the movies or something else like that? Or do you think something else might weigh into the decision? And then I guess the last point on this, you know, just going to throw a lot at you here, right, one after the other, is how long do you think it'll be before we have an understanding of where LeBron is going to end up?
This is a really tough question, because this is the first year where nobody has any idea at all what LeBron is thinking. And we kind of had an idea that he wanted to team up with some other guys around free agency before he went to the Miami Heat, but we just didn't know where he was going to go. But right now, the Los Angeles Lakers probably have the most steam right now, but we really don't know what LeBron is going to do. Yes, we know that he wants to form another super team in order to defeat the Golden State Warriors, but there's just a lot of teams that make sense, but each team has their own strengths and weaknesses. Excuse me. He could stay in Cleveland, but they're very cap strapped. They have some really bad contracts on their payroll. Tristan Thompson, J.R. Smith, George Hill, the list goes on and on. And those contracts really do restrict him from bringing another superstar in there with him. So if he was to go back to Cleveland, I think there would be significant changes to the roster, and I don't think anybody on that roster would be untradeable. Obviously, besides LeBron, he would be the only one, but other than that, they probably would have a totally revamped roster. But the other options, I think the other realistic options are, like I said earlier, the Los Angeles Lakers, but I just don't see him wanting to play with a whole bunch of kids. What I mean by that is like Lonzo Ball, Brandon Ingram, Kyle Kuzma, and all those other guys that are out there. I just don't see him wanting to go to a team that has zero playoff experience. Yes, they do have two maximum cap spots that they can fit in for max players, but I just don't see him wanting to go to a team like that with guys that have zero playoff experience, because the next team he goes to, he wants to build it in order to beat the Warriors. And I don't think he wants to go out west either. He spent his entire career in the Eastern Conference, and he has dominated it to this point. And I just don't see why he would want to go out to that gauntlet out west. The other two options are the Houston Rockets. But obviously, they're cap strapped as well. Chris Paul is a free agent. James Harden he signed the Supermax last summer. So he's taking up a lot of money as well. They have to re-sign Clint Capella. He's a restricted free agent, and I'm sure some team is probably going to give him a max offer as well. So they don't have a lot of cap money in order to afford LeBron, and Daryl Morey has to finagle some contracts around if he does want to sign LeBron, but they're going to have to get rid of some key pieces as well. Eric Gordon would definitely be a guy that they have to get rid of. in order to afford LeBron. And he was obviously a key core piece for them this past year. And the option that I think is the most realistic right now and may be at the top of his list is the Philadelphia 76ers. And why do I say that? Him and Ben Simmons are very close. Ben Simmons is a part of his agency with Rich Paul and Maverick Carter. Those two guys are his representatives. And he sees Ben Simmons as his protege and a guy that reminds him a lot of himself coming into the league. They have another key piece there in Joel Embiid, both of those guys. Simmons is still in his rookie contract. Embiid just signed an extension, but it's not a supermax extension. It's a guy that's just coming off his rookie deal. So he's not making that regular $219 million. Like a regular max slot guy would make. I believe he's only making $135 million. So they do have a lot of room in Philadelphia. If they do want to fit LeBron there, it's still in the Eastern Conference, and he gets to play with two ascending pieces in Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid, and they just need to find out some fillers as far as shooters. Dario Saric is still there as well, a guy who fits in very well with LeBron because he's a guy that can shoot on the perimeter. So if I had to rank it, I probably would rank it right now. I would put Philly at the top. L.A. Lakers would probably be second, and the Houston Rockets would be third, with the Cleveland Cavaliers a distant fourth. I just don't see why he would want to go back there. He's promised them and accomplished his promise as far as bringing that city a championship. I just don't see how much more or what more he could accomplish there. So that's how I would rank LeBron's rankings.
Can you give me a dark horse team in the East? Because like you said, I mean, the teams that are getting talked about the most, you got the Lakers, you got the Rockets out West. But I just can't, I mean, just with LeBron being as smart as he is and the ultimate goal being, you know, championships and beating the Warriors, I just can't see him going out West and having to go through that gauntlet just because the percentages of him getting to the finals go down if he has to go and deal with all that out in the West. Like, is there a dark horse team in the East that we're not thinking about that might be able to do a little something to get him in there? Not Boston. I can't see him going to Boston. No Boston fans keep talking about that, but I don't see that happening. LeBron seems to really, really, really dislike Boston. But is there another team that you could think of that would make sense that he might that have pieces or flexibility that maybe people aren't talking about that he might end up that's out East?
It's a extremely long shot, and I don't really see it happening. But if there was a dark horse, I would say the Washington Wizards, just because that's a it's the nation's capital. It's a town that could fit his personality. They have John Wall and Bradley Beal there, two guys that fit very well with LeBron's skill set. Now, they probably would have to get rid of Otto Porter just because of how much money he is making. I believe he's making close to $100 million. So they would have to find a way to get rid of his contract in order to afford LeBron. But I would say the Wizards would be a dark horse.
Okay. All right. Well, we got that out the way. And, you know, I feel like right now is I have to put like the breaking news sound or something because, you know, breaking news, ladies and gentlemen. The man, the myth, the legend, the wide receiver one, the last cornerback to put the clamps on Adam Thielen, Miles Gorham has joined us. What is going on, my man? How you doing? And is the internet going to hold up for us?
I don't know. Doubt it.
Hey, so far, so good. So far, so good. We will keep the faith, and we'll just make sure you keep your answer short. You know that? We don't want to put too much pressure on it. But you're here now, and we're going to jump into some football. And so I'm gonna throw this to you just right off the bat so we can, you know, get you in here while the internet's still running hot. Is, you know, kind of an underreported story, I guess. You know, we talked about it a little bit. It kind of popped up, and then it was seemed to be kind of quickly pushed out of the way. But the NCAA is changing the transfer rule. And, yeah, I guess, Miles, start with you. I guess, can you give us a kind of a high-level overview of how things are changing? And then, I guess, what are your thoughts on this and what the ramifications might be for I guess, big-time college sports?
Yeah, so it sounds like the NCAA, what they're looking to do is allow kids to transfer whenever and wherever they want without permission from the school they're currently at. And JR, correct me if I'm wrong here, but they also don't have to sit out a year to do it?
No, the regular transfer rules still apply. They just don't have to get permission.
Okay, yeah. So I think what it just means, though, basically is for these kids, it's just, you know, if they go in their freshman year and things don't go well, they get redshirted or whatever. I think you're going to see a lot of guys transfer schools, and it's going to be open season for these schools because they can talk to these these players without permission, without them having to be released from their schools. So you're going to see, you know, a lot of under the table deals. You know, it's crazy with the high school kids, but imagine some of these college kids with all the potential that a lot of these kids have. And, you know, some of them are even, you know, seeing the field early on and, you know, they're just not liking the school or whatever. And it's open season for that. So I think the NCAA is doing themselves a disservice with it, because they've been trying to stop all the under the table deals. But I mean, this is just going to make it 10 times worse, in my opinion.
And I guess just one of the things that you brought up kind of in the group chat when you were talking about this, and I'll get JR in after you answer on this one, is that you mentioned like kids coming in and redshirting and maybe not getting the shine or the playing time that they think they deserve. And I know that the kind of the initial thought on this is that, you know, the rich get richer. It'll make it easier for like the Alabamas and, you know, the Clemsons, et cetera, to kind of pull talent in, I guess. But could you see scenarios in which kind of the opposite is true, where, you know, those schools, because they do have so much talent, you know, that five-star recruit that comes in who thought he might get playing time, who's never sat on the bench, you know, a day in his life, comes in and is, you know, the third guy on the depth chart. I guess, do you think we might see more movement kind of the other way, with guys leaving those big time programs to go make their name and maybe a tier below the top program, so that they can get in there and dominate maybe a slightly lower tier of competition?
Yeah, I think the biggest case with that too is you just see there's so much more exposure for small school kids nowadays than there used to be. So, a lot more guys aren't flying through under the radar the way they used to. So I think you see a lot of five-star kids coming out of high school who don't play, or they don't live up to that five-star standard in the, you know, the SEC or, you know, some of those power five schools. So they go to those smaller schools so I think, yeah, you could see some of these smaller schools get some opportunities with some of these five-star recruits, because, you know, those kids know that they're going to go to a school like I'll use Wyoming as an example for this, just because, you know, we've seen, you know, some, you know, guy like Josh Allen go pretty high, even though he wasn't a high recruited kid out of high school or anything. But, you know, you see a kid like you see some of these big time college quarterbacks, for example, you know, you see all these quarterbacks transferring schools like Shea Patterson and going to Michigan, and I can't remember the Clemson kid's name going to Ohio or leaving Ohio State, one Ohio State kid leaving to go to LSU, all that good stuff like that. Like, you see these guys, they're gonna have an opportunity to talk to every school they want to, kind of like it was like they did in high school. But, you know, they're gonna have college opportunities, you know, under their belt already, so they kind of know the situation that's going on a little bit more than they did coming out of high school. So they can weigh those situations a lot better for themselves. So what they can do is they can really determine where they can go, where they're really going to have a legit opportunity to start and play and be an, you know, heavy impact player right away. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that now than what you kind of saw before, just because those contact opportunities that they're going to be able to have is, you know, a lot higher.
All right. JR, what are your thoughts, man, on kind of everything that Miles had to say there? And I guess just generally speaking, the decision in general for players to be able to move a little bit more freely based on kind of how they're feeling about things once they get into the college system.
Yeah, I agree with every point that Miles said. And the biggest argument that prospects were bringing up about this entire situation was that coaches are able to move freely whenever they want to. And they were saying, why can't the players do the same? And that was the biggest argument brought to the table when trying to get this rule approved through the NCAA, and it ended up getting approved, obviously. And I love the rule. I think players should be able to move freely from whichever school that they want to. But obviously, the transfer rules still apply as far as kids on the FBS level. If they go to an FBS school, they transfer to an FBS school, they still have to sit out a year. But if they go down a level, they're able to play as soon as they enroll into that school. And what you have now is basically it's like an open free agency period for these schools. And what you're going to see is you're going to see some of these highly touted recruits hop from school to school. You're going to see guys go from LSU to Alabama and from Alabama to Ole Miss, something like that, even though they do have to sit out a year. So there's going to be a lot of behind the scenes recruiting, but I think it's fair because of the whole coaching situation and how coaches are able to jump from school to school. And now these recruits or players are able to do the same now. And I think it's only fair to have that cohesion and that existence now. So I'm a fan of the rule, and I can't wait to see the first big-time recruit transfer out of an SEC school or ACC school to another school of that caliber to see how it works out.
Nor can I, and I cannot wait for the angry old man takes that are sure to ensue when that does happen. Loyalty, blah, 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 etc. Kind of like things that are going to come up a couple topics from now once people probably hear what we have to say about that. But the next thing here, people getting paid, man. People getting paid. Zach Martin agreed to an $84 million extension, signing bonus, $20 million, yearly average $14 million, second highest paid offensive lineman behind Nate Solder. So I guess my question for you guys, JR, we'll start with you on this one here. With the money Norwell and Martin are getting paid now, is the interior offensive line market officially out of hand?
I don't think so, just because of I know it's probably not going to match up with the positional value chart as far as analytics and things of that nature. But I'm starting to think, and the NFL is starting to think the same, that interior linemen are more valuable than tackles because of how versatile and how important and how athletic these interior defensive linemen are starting to get. And you talk about Ndamukong Suh and Aaron Donald being on the same team. You really have to have a really good interior offensive line, or interior offensive line to be so talented because of how talented and athletic these defensive linemen are. And the quickest way to get to the quarterback is with those defensive tackles and those nose tackles, because they can go easily from point A to point B going north and south, as opposed to defensive ends that have to bend the arc and get around to get to the quarterback. So I'm fine with interior offensive linemen getting paid as much as they are, because I think their value is definitely increasing, and the market is definitely indicative of that as the market inflation is going higher and higher. Norwell reset the market this offseason, and Zach Martin only improved that a bit more with the contract that he just signed, and obviously the tackle market is eventually going to catch up to it. But I think the NFL is starting to value those interior offensive linemen more than tackles, just because of how athletic these interior defensive linemen are starting to be.
And you made a really good point there. And it's funny because it's something that that Eric Eager, you know, PFF Eric, you know, friend of the show with me on the Pocket Protectors, also does the PFF forecast. But it's something that we actually were just talking about, because Cynthia Freeland at NFL.com put out a piece talking about the value of interior pressure. It was either a piece or a video clip that was on the site talking about the value of interior pressure and why Aaron Donald should get paid all the money that he's getting paid, which, of course, you know, Eric jumped into. He gave us kind of a sneak preview, but I haven't been able to actually listen to the whole episode. But the most recent episode of the PFF forecast actually gets into a lot of the points that you just made, JR, in terms of interior pressure versus edge pressure, what happens more often, what hurts an offense more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So as you were going through all of that, it was reminding me that many of those points you were making, kind of comparing the positions, are being discussed in kind of a deeper analytic look. So I'll link to that in the show notes as well. And we'll probably circle back, if not on this podcast, on the Pocket Protectors, and kind of talk through those points about, you know, who should be getting paid and why, based on kind of everything JR was just talking about there. And I'm not going to come with a counterpoint because I don't actually know what Eric said in the full analysis. So yeah, just reminded me that's what they were going to be talking about. So I figured I'd give our friend a plug. Miles, JR said a lot of good things there, and then I kind of took us on a tangent. So I'm going to need you to bring us back in and not necessarily kind of talk about what JR just talked about again, but the Dallas Cowboys have invested quite a bit in that offensive line now, with, you know, Teron Smith, Zach Martin, Travis Frederick. Like, do they have too much money invested in that offensive line? And with all the money they have tied up there, are they going to be able to A, pay Dak, B, surround him with the weapons that he needs? And then as those defensive players that they have that are actually not bad players start to need to get paid, are they going to be able to keep this team together for long enough to make them a competitive team with all that money they have tied up in the offensive line, and not just the offensive line, but I guess really the interior offensive line?
Yeah. It's a tough situation for me, just because I think they can't even still tell what their best necessary, you know, need for success is. Obviously, it seems like they feel like building the offensive line is the most important aspect for the rest of their team because they've invested so heavily in it, in terms of money and draft picks and all that stuff. But it just says to me that they really still are unsure about a guy like Dak Prescott. It tells me that they do believe that it's the pressure aspect of it that's the issue. Not you know they saw with when Tyron Smith went down last year. They had a lot of issues with sacks and, you know, all that good stuff, which makes sense. He's the best left tackle in the game. It's kind of hard to replace him. But at the same time, it just feels like that's where they feel that their most valuable asset should be in terms of money, because they do have Zeke, you know, Zeke and, you know, Dak can run some of that read option with Zeke. So I feel like that's what their plan is. They want to be a ground and pound type of team. They want to, you know, keep, you know, ball control type of stuff, which, you know, we've kind of learned that you can debunk some of that, because that stuff's not as important as you know, maybe quote unquote used to be in terms of how you run offenses nowadays. Passing the ball in an efficient way is definitely a better, you know, you're more likely to get, you know, more chunk plays and all that good stuff doing that than you are running the ball 35, 40 times a game, which they really make it seem like that's what their plan is. Because they didn't really surround Dak with anything new in terms of weapons. They got rid of Dez. Jason Witten retired. And what they do, all they did was draft Michael Gallup, which who I like, but him to replace Dez. And then is it Dalton Schultz from Notre Dame? Or is it Stanford? I can't remember. But so they bring in those guys to replace those two high-profile players. But those guys, day one, aren't going to be better than those guys were last year. So I think
you're disrespecting Allen Hurns like that, man.
And you know, it ain't even right. But I ain't even about that. Like, Allen Hurns is fine. He's a good player. But is he a true number one receiver?
Absolutely not.
Right. So, like, that's the biggest issue. So they don't have a true number one playmaker on the outside. They may have a few guys that are pretty good in a vacuum in terms of. In a core group of guys like Cole Beasley and Terrence Williams is what he is. But like, you have all those guys in a group. It's not terrible, but they don't have anybody to really lead them. So who's Dak's go-to? It's going to have to be Allen Hurns, which, you know, that dude's leading your team in receiving. Like, double him and then what? Like, I don't know what they're going to do. So that's the biggest issues. If you really want to know what your QB can do, give him the best opportunity with the weapons around him, but that's not what they really want to do. So they find it the most important aspect is building that offensive line, and they feel that's how they're going to be the most successful. So we'll see if it works. Just really reminds me of like the 2012 Vikings, even though the offensive line wasn't as good back then, and Dak obviously is a 50 million times better the quarterback than Christian Ponder, but it just kind of feels that that's what they're trying to do, is do that like ground and pound type of don't turn the ball over and let your running back control the game, you know, type of situation. And I just don't think that's going to work.
All right, JR, any final thoughts on Zach Martin or the Cowboys, or how much is too much to invest in your offensive line?
I mean, that's the identity of the Dallas Cowboys. Everyone knows that they're known for their offensive line, and good players like that, you can't just let walk out the door. He hasn't missed a game in his entire NFL career, played 64 straight games. He's reliable, been the best, probably the best interior offensive lineman in the league for the past few years. I think they're highly of Zach Martin. He sets the tone of their offensive line. So you just can't let that walk out the door, especially when you don't have anyone behind him at the moment who can play at a high level like he has the past 3 or 4 years. So I think it was well worth the money.
Okay. Well, speaking of being worth the money, you know, we doing seamless segues all night tonight on the Welcome Back podcast of the Climb Into a Pocket Pod here. Julio Jones wants some more of it. He thinks he's worth more than he's getting paid. He feels like the market has been reset. And he's not attending mandatory minicamp. JR, what are your thoughts on Julio skipping minicamp?
Yeah, so this topic is just ridiculous to me. especially when some fans really discuss it, like, oh, he shouldn't have signed for as long as he did. And I completely understand that he's locked into a contract. He signed a 5-year extension when he did. And the biggest thing that he didn't understand was market inflation. We know that's going to happen when they sign such long deals. I've been a huge advocate of NFL players not signing deals over 3 years long, but I understand why they sign such long deals, because they're not guaranteed like the NBA and baseball contracts. So they have to sign these longer deals to ensure that they get more guaranteed money on the front end, because they're not going to get it throughout the tenure of the entire contract like other leagues get. I understand that. But on the flip side, when you have an elite talent like Julio Jones is, I think you should be able to rip that contract up, especially after a few years, especially if he's been producing. He's played at a high level. Yes, the touchdown numbers have been low, but his yard numbers have stayed consistent. He's been a consistent threat in that offense, and I think he's a guy that should always be paid like a top five guy at that position. And we've seen guys like Jarvis Landry, Davante Adams, and Sammy Watkins get paid. And I just think he's worth way more than what those guys are getting. And I believe Julio is still in the top 10 of receivers getting paid, but there's just no reason that those guys should be getting more money than he should. And I think he has the right to hold out despite 3 years being left on his contract. And I mean, if he doesn't report to camp, I would completely understand. Now, if he starts to miss games, I don't think that would be understandable. But as far as him holding out for more money on his contract, I'm completely fine with that, because he's a guy that deserves that type of money no matter what.
Yeah, Miles, and more of a general question for you, not necessarily just Julio, but if you want to bring it back to Julio, by all means, feel free. I guess, what are your thoughts in general about players kind of holding out when they do have multiple years left on the contract? Like, we often see this when guys are coming to the end there and they don't want to go out and maybe risk injury before they re-up on the money. And, you know, it's understandable. Fans seem to be a little bit more, flexible, understanding, lenient, whatever word you want to use there in those situations. But in the situation like this, where like the market is obviously different than it was when you signed your deal, or quite frankly, you've just outperformed the deal that you initially signed. I guess, what are your thoughts on players really using the only leverage they have, which is showing up to try to get more money, even if they did just sign a deal or they do have multiple years left on their deal?
Yeah, I think one thing people really do tend to forget is what players do is the first opportunity they get, they're going to take the best deal that they can get. So like, even if that deal is a 4-year, 5-year deal, these players are going to take the most money that they can get, especially up front. And if that requires them doing a longer term deal at a time, they're going to take it because they need to do it for what's best for them. But then after 2 years in that deal, if you've outperformed that deal, I totally understand trying to get more opportunity, more money for yourself, because you've earned that. You've outplayed the current contract. And you've seen players like Antonio Brown do stuff like that. And teams who know how valuable that player is understand that, and they say, we need to make sure that we take care of the guys that we know are important to our core and are still in our long-term plans. So like, there's got to be that definitely a give and take. The both sides have to kind of have an understanding of where you're at. I do understand the team side of, you signed your contract, you know, you have, let's say, 3 years left on your deal. You know, some teams like the Vikings, for example, they're pretty steady on the fact that they usually don't extend. And I know it's been a little bit different for guys like Everson Griffin and Linval Joseph, just because I know they did that for their future plans. But normally what the Vikings don't do is they usually don't look to negotiate long-term or further extensions with guys until they have at least 2 years left, probably less than 2 years left in their deal before they even consider re-upping a guy. So I know some of these teams definitely abide by a lot of those rules just because of the way they plan for their cap and everything like that. So I know there's a lot of that going on, but you know, in Julio's case, I'll bring it back to Julio. He's 29 years old now. He's basically at the peak of his career, where he's going to be at the best, you know, at the peak where he's going to be the best of, you know, the rest of his career. So him trying to get the most money he can right now makes so much sense. You have the leverage because you're still arguably the best, or, you know, if not one of the top two best receivers in the league. Go get your money, go get paid, so that, you know, by the time you have that long-term security for yourself, because Julio turns 30 in February. So I can understand the team side of it not wanting to extend him long-term with bigger cap hits down the road when he's going to be 30 plus. And we've seen receivers drop off quite a bit after they hit 30. But, you know, if I'm a team like the Falcons, to kind of appease the guy that you have that's in place, that's the focal point of your offense and your passing game, why wouldn't you want to do like a shorter termed, more money up front type of deal anyways? That's, if I was them, that'd be kind of the thought process I have, is I'll pay him all of the money now in the next, I don't know what their cap situation is, so I could be completely wrong on this, but why not just pay him all the money in the next, what, 2 to 3 years, and just, you know, make it pretty front loaded, you know, heavy front loaded, so that in the back end, when he does start to fade, you don't have to pay him. You don't have those high, you know, cap hits that you'll need down the road. So that's just an idea that I'd have if I was them. That'd be the way I'd be looking at it, to restructure it in that sense instead of the long-term deals. But, and for Julio, because that's going to appease a guy like Julio too, because he wants that money up front. So I think it's good for Julio in this time. Take that opportunity whenever you can, and when you have leverage like he does, to try to get the most money you can, because these guys are putting their – like Mike Zimmer said it on KFan, I think it was yesterday. He understands that these guys are – how much they're sacrificing, what they're putting their bodies through to do this. So he totally understands what they're putting their bodies through, so that they – you know, basically for the money that they're getting. So – whenever they have an opportunity to get more money, why not take that opportunity? So I totally understand it. And I don't think it's a big deal now. It's mini camp. It's not like Julio's a third year player looking for his first deal after his rookie deal or whatever. Even though Odell's in a similar situation, and I don't blame him for holding out either. But in Julio's sense, I totally get it, because you want to cash out at least one last time. You do what you got to do.
Yeah, and it looks like Julio's probably trying to get some of that 2020 money moved to 2019. Falcons right now sitting at $6.8 million in cap space per over the cap. They do have a grip of cap space next year, though, in 2019, $32 million as of right now. So maybe Julio's trying to get some money moved around. But, I mean, I can also get the Falcons' perspective on this one, kind of looking at their situation, because Julio's their second biggest cap number right now. So I guess it's going to have to be how they move the money around to get him maybe more cash now without really affecting his cap number too much. But yeah, I mean, he's already the second highest cap number they have after Matt Ryan on the team. So I can understand both perspectives on this one. Julio's getting old, wants his money. Falcons already looking at like, yo, like we're paying you a grip of money as it stands right now. And the only person on the team making more than you is Matt Ryan. But guess we'll see how that plays out. And Miles, you kind of danced around it a little bit. I don't know if it was purposeful or not purposeful, but you know, I tweeted out the other day, you know, pay Stephon Diggs, and you know, JR jokingly tweeted, but what about Adam Thielen? Which, you know, got some people really actually going for real about, you know, Adam Thielen has to get paid as Stephon Diggs get paid. Obviously, I think we're all on the same page. One person's money situation has absolutely nothing to do with the other. With that all said, and all the points that were just made about Julio Jones, JR, I'll start with you. Should Adam Thielen hold out, just based on how he's performed and what he's due to make, even though he just signed that contract?
Yeah, I think he should. I'm all about players getting their market value and their true worth. Adam Thielen took a risk signing that extension when he did. I thought it was a bad risk, and he got bad advice about the situation. But once again, it goes back to NFL contracts being non-guaranteed, and he thought this was an opportunity for him to cash in, and that's what he did, signing that extension. And it proved to be a mistake, because if he would have waited to after prior to last season ending and then get an extension, he obviously probably would have got Devontae Adams like money, honestly, in my opinion. I'm always an advocate for players getting their market value. Why do I say that? Because teams are able to rip up these contracts and cut these players at any moment with multiple years left on their deals. So why can't these players come back and request more money, even though they have multiple years left on their deal and they're liable to get cut at any moment. I just think it needs to be a two-way street. And we all know the NFL is an owners-driven league, but the players need to somehow use their leverage in contract negotiations as well.
Love it, love it, love it. Miles, you on the same page, or you got a different perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think Adam Thielen definitely was in a little bit of a different situation than, you know, a lot of those guys who are looking to get paid like a Davante Adams just because of the leverage. You know, Adam Thielen, he really had a career year probably at the worst time for him in terms of upfront money, just because that was probably the best deal he was going to get at the time. It looked like, because if teams knew what Adam Thielen was going to become in that second, this last year, they would have easily given up a second round pick to nab him from the Vikings. I mean, you know, a top 10-ish wide receiver in the league at his age, 27, almost 28, or well, last year would have been, you know, 27. You know, you're going to more than likely probably give up a second round pick to get a guy of that caliber. So he took the best available money that he was going to get. And I don't blame him for that. You take what you can get, especially for a guy that's undrafted. Finally got his opportunity, if you know, 3 years down the road or whatever it was. And then so he cashed in when he got the opportunity. And now, you know, a year later, he's like, hey, I even outplayed that money. You know, we should definitely be talking about that again, where we could re-up my contract again, because he's definitely one of those guys that seems like he'd probably would like to just retire a Viking down the road. So I'm sure the Vikings would love that too. So I'm sure they'll probably try to look to work something out after the season. But if I'm the Vikings, I'm making him play out one more season before I even consider giving him an extension, just because of the way everything's lined up. You have other guys that are higher priorities because their contracts expire after the season. So I think that's just the tough part for Adam Thielen. If he held out, that's up to him. I'm all for it, just because, like JR said, the players should get the money that they deserve. Do what you got to do. Use the power that you have to make sure that, you know, the team knows that you're serious about it. But at the end of the day, I don't see Adam Thielen doing it. Like I said, if he does, good for him. But I just don't think the team should be worrying about his contract until after the season. Take care of the guys that are contracts expire after the season. Stephon Diggs, Anthony Barr, Danielle Hunter. Make sure those guys are locked up, because then you can reevaluate and know what your cap situation is going to be next offseason, so that you can look at guys who are in need of a, you know, potential contract extensions, like, you know, Adam Thielen, you know, whatever they want to do with Anderson Dejo and then Trey Waynes and stuff like that. So, and Mackenzie Alexander's in that boat too. Sheldon Richardson too. So like, you want to know what you're going into the 2019 season with in terms of cap, as long as you can lock up the guys that are due this coming year. So
all right, great points there. And you know, like that Miles did bring it back and bring the team's perspective, because I think that does make a lot of sense. And I think that's also really the underlying point that a lot of us were trying, maybe not as eloquently, to make when we say that, you know, Diggs's contract and Thielen's contract really have nothing to do with one another. It's really, yeah, from the team perspective, Thielen isn't as much of a priority, not because he's not very good, because he's under contract. So if Thielen wants to sit out and not play, then Thielen would need to deal with those ramifications, the fines, all that kind of stuff. But
right, that money goes back to the team.
Yeah. So yeah, that the way that you stated that makes a lot of sense there. And it obviously, it goes back to why, you know, Diggs should get paid now, and we shouldn't be talking about the Adam Thielen thing every time we talk about Stephon Diggs getting paid, because their situations are very different. With that said, now we're going to go to the part of the show where I shamelessly plug something that I just wrote, because I actually wrote something and, you know, I want people to read it. So if you're listening to this, you know, go read the latest piece that I put up on Climbing the Pocket, where we talk about the way too early supporting cast rankings for all 32 teams in the NFL. And obviously, I posted it and everyone on the internet immediately agreed with everything I had to say. So it was a lot of fun. Of course, that didn't happen. And so, you know, JR, Miles, I want to get your perspective. What are your thoughts? Which teams, and I guess we'll just say top three, we'll make it easy for you. Which teams from your perspective have the, you know, the top three best offenses or offensive supporting casts? Either one. And JR, you can kick us off.
This one was tough for me, because there's so many good supporting casts around the league. I think there's two that really stand out. Obviously, the Steelers. I think that's one of the top ones. You have Le'Veon Bell in the backfield, Antonio Brown, Juju Smith-Schuster on the perimeter, and even adding a guy like James Washington now in the fold, who I think is going to fit in very well as a number three receiver there. I think that's a very good supporting cast. My next one will probably be the Vikings, because this is exactly what Kirk Cousins needs. You don't build an offense around Kirk Cousins, but he's a guy that you plug into an already ready-made situation. He has Dalvin Cook and Latavius Murray behind him, and then he has Diggs and Thielen on the perimeter along with Kyle Rudolph. And I'm even going to add in a guy like Kendall Wright as well, who I think is a perfect number three receiver in this offense as well. So that probably would be my number two. My number three was a bit of a toss-up, and I'm going a little bit of a different route here. I'm going to go with the Chargers. I really like what they offer on offense. Keenan Allen obviously is a stud. I hate Hunter Henry went down, but I'm just going to add him in the fold, even though he did go down with a torn ACL, and they have Melvin Gordon in the backfield as well. So those three would definitely be my top three.
Okay. All right. Not too bad. Got a couple of them in there with my way of looking at it. Miles, what are your thoughts? Where are you going? And I'm sure you're pretty happy that JR gave your man a shout out in his analysis.
Yeah, I honestly think if Hunter Henry hadn't gone down, I would have considered putting the Chargers in there, but I don't think I can do that just because I think he was going to be a big focal point of that offense this season. But for me, I think it's got to start with Atlanta. I think just the combination of everything they have with the, Matt Ryan, Julio Jones, drafting a guy like Calvin Ridley, Mohamed Sanu, and then having the arguably, I'd say the second best running back tandem in the league behind the Saints with Tevin Coleman and Devontae Freeman. I think the only thing they're really truly missing is a legit tight end. So, but I think otherwise, I think they having that third receiver in Calvin Ridley really does help with the idea of not having one of those top tier tight ends, those really good pass catching tight ends. And Austin Hooper is still evolving, so we'll see what he does. Number two for me. The tough part, I'd probably have to go with the Pittsburgh Steelers, I'll say the Steelers just because I think they have the best wide receiver and best running back, arguably the best running back in the league. And I think Antonio Brown's the best receiver in the league. So I think they have all the weapons you could ask for. Even getting rid of a guy like Martavis Bryant doesn't even hurt them that much, just for the fact the way they've been able to develop wide receivers. They go and draft James Washington, and they have Juju Smith-Schuster going into a sophomore season. They have a pretty damn good offensive line, so I think that offense is really good and they've always been good. They've always had weapons, so I think it's nothing new for them to be in the top five-ish for, offensive talent. So they'd be my number two. And number three for me would – this is a tough one. I'd probably have to agree with JR with the Minnesota Vikings on this one being number three right now with everything he said. Stephon Diggs, Adam Thielen, Kyle Rudolph, Dalvin Cook, Latavius Murray, Kendall Wright as a number three, or Laquon Treadwell if he somehow does anything. So they have a bevy of weapons that they can kind of play with, and a new offensive coordinator that with Kirk Cousins that can push the ball downfield and kind of spread things around.
Okay, all right. Well, I mean, I'm gonna go slightly different way. My first two in the article that I wrote were the Falcons and the Steelers. So you guys both touched on those ones there, but the next one here. Neither of you mentioned, that I'm a little surprised that you didn't mention, but I can understand it as well. It's the Kansas City Chiefs. I feel like when I'm looking at what they have done there, that offense could be very exciting. I know that obviously we have the unknown of Patrick Mahomes coming in, but I mean the weapons they had last year were able to turn Alex Smith into a top five quarterback statistically. And then they went and added Sammy Watkins to that. So as I'm looking at it and you're kind of going through, you got You know, Patrick Mahomes, you got Kelsey, you got Hill, you got Watkins, you got Hunt. I mean, I have a tough time seeing with those weapons how that offense isn't going to be a lot of fun. And then the next one for me, not necessarily top three, but just a sleeper team that I think could potentially bounce back, not even bounce back, could really ascend in this year, is the Tennessee Titans. They have the great offensive line. Corey Davis was a prospect that, you know, everyone loved. So hopefully he can take a step forward. You got Delanie Walker, who continues to play at a very high level, even though he's older. Rishard Matthews may very well be the most underrated wide receiver in the game. Just goes out there and does it pretty much everywhere he goes at a highly efficient level. Added Deion Lewis. They obviously have Derrick Henry. Taywan Taylor is a player, a prospect that I really liked. He's going to be ideally stepping into a bigger role in the slot in this new offense. And so the Titans are a team that I will be paying attention to this year, because I think they have a really, really good chance to be a surprise team as things move forward in the 2018 season. All right. Well, I guess, you know, we are a Vikings podcast. So we can't really get out of here before we talk about, you know, what just happened. And we had some mini camp. So Miles, you've really been keeping up with this a little bit more than you know, I know I have. I was away on vacation, so I've been trying to get caught up on all those types of things. So Miles, mini camp, Vikings, give us your general thoughts. What's going on? Which players have been standing out? What are the coaches saying? What do the listeners need to know about what went on at the Vikings minicamp?
Yeah, so it just sounds, you know, it sounds like the defense is, you know, in this type of situation, I think people need to remember in minicamp and, you know, offseason programs, there's no pads. A lot of the things that the teams, especially offenses, are doing is they're trying new things out. They're trying things that they want to see if they want to bring into the potentially bring into training camp. So take that with a grain of salt. Obviously, the Vikings have, you know, arguably the best, if not a top 3 to 5 defense in the league. So there's definitely going to be growing pains for the offense to go against, you know, how, especially a defense that basically improved from a year ago, which is crazy to think about. But the offense is starting to come together a little bit. But the defense, you know, has done a pretty good job of, you know, taking away a lot of the things that the offense has tried to do. So I think there's that. It just kind of just reaffirms how good our defense is, and how stacked they are top to bottom. Mike Hughes, the Vikings first round pick, is, I think he's exceeded expectations so far, which is pretty crazy to think about just because he never really played. He's never played the nickel position, but he's battling with Mackenzie Alexander right now. And it sounds like Mike Zimmer said that to date, you know, since he's been with the Vikings, that he's the best corner he's seen in their first year transitioning to the nickel position that he's seen since he's been in Minnesota. So I think that's pretty high praise, especially from someone like Mike Zimmer, who doesn't really give out praise all that often to young guys.
Miles, I just got to say, I am dying internally right now as I listen to you talk about Mike Hughes and all the accolades that he's getting while you're trying to hold it together and be all professional. Oh yeah, Mike Zimmer had some really good things to say about Mike Hughes. And yeah, you know, it sounds like Mike Hughes is doing really well here at training camp. And I know that all you want to do is really just, you know, rub it in everyone's face. Cause you know, that was your dude, that was your cornerback one. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, great movement skills and, you know, hips and all that stuff in the pre-draft run up. And I know that, you know, you got to be loving it just a little bit right now that, you know, your guy is going in and defying the odds, playing a position he never played before, and by all accounts, doing big things. I mean, that's got to feel a little good though, right?
Yo, for sure. I mean, I think especially the position, we all expect and just assume that defensive players for Mike Zimmer, especially cornerbacks, they're not going to have that big of an impact early on. And I think for me, I said that's why, you know, I had Mike Hughes as my cornerback one coming out. So for me, I said, you know, even coming to Minnesota, I still expect him to have an impact on defense because I think he's that good. So some of this doesn't surprise me just because of, you know, on film, that's just kind of what I saw. I saw a guy that, you know, has all those skills to even play in the nickel, even if he hasn't before. So to hear for a complex defense the way Zim has, and for especially his nickel position, the way they you know, mask and play a combo of zone and man schemes, it is kind of crazy to kind of think about a guy like Mike Hughes being able to kind of pick it up pretty early on. for a guy his age and a guy that doesn't have that much experience, especially in that position. So it is, it's pretty cool to think about. And it makes you really excited heading into training camp, how things are really going to go. And it just reaffirms to me that he does have a legit opportunity to win that job. And I think if he wins the job, it just makes that defense that much better, just because you know what he can do. And it slides a guy like Mackenzie Alexander outside, who's likely probably a better player on the outside than he would be in the nickel anyways. So it's exciting stuff.
Good stuff. So outside of, praise for your number one player that the Vikings picked up there, anything else, any other players standing out, anyone that we really should be going to the YouTubes to do some research on or checking out Google to figure out, their backstory ahead of training camp?
Sounds like Chad Beebe is doing pretty decent. The son of Don Beebe, the wide receiver, the kid that's wearing 84 right now.
Hope.
I don't really look too much into that. I mean, but Brandon Zylstra, the guy from Canada, sounds like he's been turning some heads pretty good. So it looks like he might have an opportunity to make the team, especially with a guy like Caleb Jones looking at that 4-game suspension. So he's one of those guys to kind of keep an eye on heading into training camp. And he could be your Mr. Mankato or Mr. Egan or whatever they're going to call it, that award. So guys like him, sounds like Rashad Hill's changed his diet and has slimmed down and gotten into a better shape. So that's a good thing. You always like to hear that because he's fighting for that right tackles position. Sheldon Richardson is definitely doing everything that they expected him to, it sounds like, and more. So that's always great to hear. I didn't even know until a couple days ago that Jalen Holmes broke his hand. The Vikings' fourth-round pick broke his hand a couple weeks ago. I didn't even know that. So, he broke his hand, but it sounds like before he did that, Mike Zimmer is pretty impressed with everything he's been doing so far. It sounds like he'll be good to go by training camp, so that's good to hear. Because he should be a part of that rotation a little bit, which is exciting. Jaleel Johnson, and they seems like has done well so far too, and it seems like they like that David Perry, the nose tackle that came from the Colts. Seems like they like him and his versatility and ability to be potentially be Linval Joseph's backup. So exciting stuff.
Exciting stuff. Optimistic times, the off season, everybody's a winner.
Did you like that I didn't mention Treadwell?
I'm proud of you, Miles. I mean, you done really well here. I mean, you had a lot of opportunities to go and, all the one-handed catches and stuff we've been seeing on the highlight reels. And, you kept yourself in check on counts, on the Treadwell account and on the Mike Hughes.
Right. I will say for Treadwell's sake, at least based off the highlight, tapes that we've seen of, their practices and stuff, he does look a little bit faster and quicker than he has in the past.
JR, how those releases looking?
Doesn't have any pads on. Don't get to that.
Yeah. No doubt. That's why I'm kind of chilling. But, he does look a little bit quicker and faster than he did this time last year. So, I think that's always a good thing. So, and it does sound like they're going to give him another opportunity to kind of play his way under the field. So, we'll see if that – and he made a comment to the reporter the other day that Kirk Cousins is actually looking his way. So, I thought that was kind of funny and kind of shade thrown, definitely. So, not that I'm not going to get my hopes up for anything, but I think sounds like John DeFilippo and Todd Downing have done some other work with him off the field to kind of make sure that they know what he has, because him being a first round pick does give him a little bit longer of a leash than a lot of guys would get. So they're going to try to give him another opportunity. So we'll see if anything pans out.
Okay. JR, anything you wanted to add in, anything that's popped up, Vikings, minicamp, or otherwise, before we wrap this thing on up?
Hey, Miles hit a lot of great points, and a lot of camp buzz is about Mike Hughes, how he's adjusting to the system. He's going back and forth between nickel and outside, but predominantly playing mostly nickel, and there's been a lot of great reviews. We rarely see Mike Zimmer come out this early and praise a rookie, especially a cornerback, and he's saying his learning curve has been really fast. So that's very encouraging to hear. Kirk Cousins seems like he's put a couple of good days together outside of the red zone period that they had the other day, which a lot of beat writers said he struggled in and that he was salty about, but he came back today and had a really nice day.
Treadwell seems to be making some highlight catches here and there. And there was one, Houghton Hill. Houghton Hill is a guy that's really starting to stand out as well. So it's good to hear some of those younger guys are adjusting and getting the grasp of the learning curve of the speed of the game.
And I, for one, am very glad that the universe immediately punished Kirk Cousins for saying booyah a bunch of times in practice.
Yes.
And he was out there saying booyah and then went and stunk up the joint in the red zone drills. And, you know, that's karmic because Kirk Cousins doesn't need to be saying booyah. Really, nobody needs to be saying booyah in the year of our Lord 2018. Let's stop that right now.
Only Stuart Scott can say that.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, all right, guys, we made it. No Sexy Prince, but we made it all the way through. Before we get up out of here, I just, again, want to thank y'all for listening. Make sure you're checking out our friends over at Vikings Territory and Purple PTSD. Checking out our boy Luke on the Purple Journal podcast. And if you haven't done it already, go on over to YouTube, subscribe. We got great content coming out on a far more regular basis than in times past. And thus far, the reception has been good. The guys from Good Morning Gjallarhorn are doing a companion kind of video pod and kind of the standard audio podcast. And thus far, the responses are good. So if you haven't already, check it out. Subscribe to the channel. And yeah, that's it. That's all I got. JR, yo, thanks for coming on. Miles, thanks for joining us. And listeners, thank you for listening. As always, my name is Jason Brown. This is the Climbing the Pocket Podcast. And we will talk to you soon. Have a good one.